Okay, good afternoon. My name is Millie Plant, and on behalf of Design Centre Chelsea Harbour, I'd like to wish you all a very warm welcome to this afternoon's design workshop. Before we start, can I ask that you kindly turn your phones off or to silent? Thank you. We are delighted that today's session is hosted by KLC School of Design. If you have any questions at all regarding courses there, Polly at the front, give a little wave, Polly. It's happy to talk to you after today's session. Right, so in which case, please give a very warm welcome to interior designer and KLC lecturer, Anna Whitehead.
Thank you very much. Oh, thank you. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for taking the time to stop by and join us for our talk here today. And we've got the post-lunch session. Yay, love a challenge. But thank you. I'd like to first of all introduce myself. My name is Anna Whitehead. Thank you, Millie. I'm a sustainable interior design consultant and lecturer, freelance, and also with KLC as well. And I'd also like to just to thank KLC for the opportunity of sharing my talk with you here today. And we've just come off the back of an inaugural Health and Wellbeing in Interiors course, which was just finished, actually. So again, thank you for that. And if you wanted more details, a bit more of that in the slide at the end. But for our session here this afternoon, I'd like to share with you my thoughts on what we need to consider when we're designing our homes for our health, well-being and happiness, when those are put down as our priorities, using biophilic design, and particularly why that's important to do now, perhaps, more than ever any time in our history, on our human history. But as it's lunch, or post-lunch, I should say, and to keep us all on our toes, I'm going to ask you to do a bit of work for me, and I promise I'll be gentle. So what I'd like you to do is to take a moment and think of a place for yourselves, real or imagined, a place that you go to in your mind or physically that suddenly makes you feel completely happy, a place that makes you feel peaceful, where you are relaxed, rested, where you are happy just to be and being there. What is it that you can see? What can you hear around you? How does it make you feel being there? Okay, and so where are you? So that being prying, if I can ask, you can happily call out if you want, but just like a quick show of hands. How many of you thought of a place, let's do this first outside, somewhere outside in the out there? Almost, okay, hands down for a second. Who thought of somewhere not outside? Wow, okay, no, this is really good. One person, by the way, in case you didn't see anything here. Okay, for those of you who thought of a place outside, where were you? So let's start with the beach, somewhere by the sea. Oh, wow, okay, about a third of you, I would imagine. Excuse me, this is an end of a cold stuff. Oh, I'm so sorry. What about forests and woodlands, streams, that kind of environment? That's about half and half, okay. What am I missing? Mountains, lakes, views, fresh air, invigorating, walking, that kind of thing. Okay, no mountaineers in the group today. How about a garden, somewhere which is scented, somewhere which is of yours, belongs to you, with flowers and scents and things like that? Anyone there? What am I missing? Anyone else? No, that's that covered all bases. Oh, wow, okay. Well, so forgive me. I'm lozenged up, which unfortunately means I'm slightly dry as well. So yes, whenever I asked students and clients where they go to in their favourite place, virtually everybody, and I'm sorry, actually out of interest, are you willing to share where you were? Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, but that's inspirational. Okay, I can give you that one. That's lovely. That's a first for me as well, so thank you for making that special for me too. But yes, whenever I ask students or clients to name a place where they feel totally at peace, virtually everybody, and thank you for helping me out with this little experiment, virtually everyone chooses a place outside in a natural environment. And when we had our inaugural Health and Wellbeing course actually last week, the same thing happened. Virtually to a person, everyone picked a place in the natural world. And I did point out the irony that actually we're here to talk about designing interiors for health and well-being. And yet we all choose where we are happiest. It's not inside, it's out there. And that's significant. Oh, but just before we move on, I shared mine with you. The kind of place I'd go to, this is my sort of favourite landscape, on the edge of a woodland with a rushing stream. It needs all of those sensory elements for me to be happy as well. But it's important that we think about that as well, because if we, and you know the statistic, it's been used so often, that we spend 90% of our lives within an interior space. 70% of that is within our homes. So for a huge chunk of our lives, are we saying that we are actually happier elsewhere? 90% is spent inside, but we are happiest when we're peaceful when we're not inside. Well, that's interesting and quite significant. And actually, maybe we need to pay more attention to that, because Delos from Australia and the International World Building Institute have said, that actually the impact that our interiors have, where we work and where we live, can deliver up to 80% of our health outcomes. That's more than genetics and lifestyle combined. Now that gives people, those of us here who are interior designers, a huge responsibility. Our designs could potentially impact clients, their health, by up to 80% by virtue of what we specify, by how we design it. That's quite a responsibility. And it also gives us quite a challenge as well. How can we create buildings and interiors that are designed to physically, cognitively, and emotionally restore us? Sorry, guys. How can we recreate these places in nature that we go to, that have got beauty, variability, and that amazing sensory feeling of well-being that being exposed and immersed in nature actually gives us? Has anyone been here, by out of interest? Okay, sell your granny to get a ticket to go there. It's amazing. You won't want to leave. It's Falling Water, Frank Lloyd Wright's home, well, for a client in Pennsylvania, but it's as beautiful as you'd imagine it to be. But how do we create these kind of places that deliver that sensory feeling? As human beings, we are biologically encoded to live within a constant changing sensory environment. We feel at our best when exposed to nature's variability. It's our cue for being alive. Think of the feeling you get when you have a whoosh, a breeze going across your face. It lifts you. Compared to that same level of oxygen delivered to you in a static, air-conditioned environment. It's clear where we feel alive. But we've left nature behind and we've moved into these fixed, static, fake habitats that we've created for ourselves, full of right angles, none of which exists in nature. So how can we be expected to be at our best? Because nothing in nature is fixed and static. It's constantly changing and regenerating. So if, as Churchill said, first we shape our buildings and afterwards they shape us, are we designing our buildings, designing them for our wellness and prioritising them for our health? And I'd argue possibly not. And we find ourselves in the midst of a health crisis. Certainly the health of the planet is clearly in question as well, but so is our health, and across the whole board. Our physical health, our emotional health, and our cognitive health is also being challenged at this particular moment in our human history by virtue of what we've created for ourselves. There are so many, on so many levels this is true, but I'm only going to pick three tiny, tiny bits, and I'll mention them throughout our session on how they can be helped, alleviated through biophilic design, but this is currently what we're facing. Our indoor air quality is known to be up to 10 times more polluted than our outdoor air, which we know breaks WHO guidelines every single year here in London. Poor indoor air quality is a trigger for asthma and other respiratory conditions, amongst other things. And the UK has the highest incidence of adult asthma in Western Europe. Particularly worrying at the moment is the trend, or the spike in trend, in children acquiring asthma symptoms. Three in every classroom will have some level of spectral asthma symptoms as well. And 40% of those will not be genetically predisposed to asthma. So they've acquired this autoimmune condition as a result of, it's thought, large exposure through indoor air, the way we clean, maintain and furnish our homes. And we've also, no pun intended here, we are sleepwalking, into an epidemic of sleep deprivation. And I got this actually from a professor at a green building conference, a medical professor that I was attending to. It's a complex reason, and I'll mention a few of those reasons why. But his point was, well, if last year's problem was obesity, and this year's problem is type 2 diabetes, next year's problem is sleep deprivation, because he's already seeing it. And he said, actually, the economic and health impact of sleep deprivation will dwarf obesity and type 2 diabetes combined. And his clarion call to us was, stop killing my patients, because from his point of view, it was partially, in his case, in his words, largely due to poor design. So we'll explain why that is as well. And this one left me quite sad, actually. Well, obviously, I suppose, because it's a study about our mental health. But the Mental Health Foundation reported that in its largest study ever conducted in the UK last year, said that 74% of the UK population felt so stressed as to be unable to cope. I thought that was really remarkable. If you extrapolate that, I don't know if you can, to the population in general, that's 3/4 of the population feeling this. Okay, it might not be literally that for that. But that's enormous. That's someone we know, unable to cope. And all of these issues, and many more that I haven't spoken of, are exacerbated by what we've managed now to do in our modern world, two ways. We have become cognitively and informationally saturated. Bear with me. There we go. In our urbanized world, as Sean Aker wrote in his book, The Happiness Advantage, the ubiquity of technology, particularly now, means that we are multitasking like we have never done. But our brains haven't caught up. Our evolutionary pattern hasn't caught up with this yet. Don't quite know how they came to this figure, but it's the same one that, you know, you hear 90% of our lives is in the interior environment. Well, the other figure you'll hear for cognitive overload will be that we are hit with about 11 million pieces of information per second. Per second. And I said, forgive me, I don't know how this came to be. But our brain hasn't evolved to deal with this barrage and onslaught yet. Our conscious brain can deal with about 40 pieces of information per second, which I still think is pretty hot. But the rest of the stuff, we're not very good at pushing away and pushing our distractions away. So they are there, looming and constantly trying to get in and barrage their way in. It's no wonder that we then feel very quickly overwhelmed, stressed, and unable to take on any more. We become known, or we start suffering from what's become known as attentional fatigue. And that's the thing that you're going to hear of more, I think, particularly in terms of our mental health. The symptoms are that we become easily distracted. It is difficult to sit, focus on a task, do it until you finish, and then get up and do something else. Things come in, so you're like a jack in a box. And I'll be honest, I suffer from this quite a bit. It's really hard for me to sit and just write for 3 hours. You know, I'm always distracted by, oh, there's a leaf, or something like that will be going on. My only get out of jail free card on this, it's worse if you're a creative, because it's where you get your next inspiration. So all those distractions can be creative, but it actually, that's my excuse, it doesn't always help either. But as well as the distractions, we are then unable to take on anything else, even social interactions. So if you were going to come in to see me and say, actually I've got an idea for a project, I'll say, okay, but I've got lots on, just make it quick, because I can't deal with any more information. Now that doesn't help creativity, collaboration, relationships, none of that. We simply can't take on any more because of the stuff that's constantly burgeoning to come in. And added to our cognitive overloads, we're also growing our habitats, these fixed habitats, to be increasingly devoid of nature. With rapid urbanization and creations of mega cities like this one, this happens to be in Asia. But the UK, I think there's a 90% of the population will live in cities, will live in a city environment by 2030. That's just a hop, skip and a jump away. And there are serious health consequences just by virtue of the fact that we're in an urban environment. It shows an increase in our stress levels, it impairs our ability to communicate, it reduces our attention. Sound familiar? Exactly the same as attentional fatigue. So we've created a world where we're information saturated and created and habitats that also then add to the same symptoms as attentional fatigue. So it's no wonder that right now we are suffering from elements of mental health issues. We're just feeling just overloaded. And the antidote to it? Well, it's immersion and exposure to nature. Nature interrupts the stress response. It improves our ability to communicate. Excuse me. And it restores our mental capacity. And perhaps it's obvious, but I'll explain why. Or those of us who are old enough to remember the TV ads, here comes the science bit, so bear with me. Just before I move off from this one, actually, that one, the picture's here. This is Amazon's headquarters in Seattle, which has been entirely biophilically designed to, I suppose, resemble something of Kew Gardens or a rainforest. And this one is Singapore Airport, their rainforest biome. That's nothing like Heathrow. We need more of this. Okay, so whenever we see images of nature or natural environment, when we experience them, there is, it affects a part of our brain that's linked with our positive emotions. We get a surge of serotonin and dopamine feelings, those kind of hormones course through our body, the real happiness stuff, the feel-good stuff. And when we start feeling that, the impact it has is direct on our brains. It changes our brainwave to frazzled, and it literally does look like that, it's extraordinary how nature mimics it, to these gentle sinusoidal waves called alpha waves. And alpha waves are synonymous with feeling calm, with rest, with meditation. When we talk about mindfulness, for example, that's the alpha state we wish to get into. And suddenly, neuroscientists have also correlated that there's a direct link between an increase in alpha brainwave activity and a corresponding decrease, a sharp decrease in depression symptoms. And at the same time, an uptick in able to collaborate, but creativity goes way up. So being in an alpha state is really good for us. It suddenly engenders relationships and conversations. So now, yes, please come into my office, yeah, pull up a chair, let's talk about our project. How have you been? It's a completely different conversation suddenly when we're in that alpha, calmed, relaxed state. So what happens when we're in urban views? What happens in our brains then? Well, when we're in urban views, this is associated with... Sorry, I have just moved out. Can you still hear me well enough? So sorry, guys. Didn't want to cough and echo it. When we're in urban views, this is associated with an entirely different part of our brain. This is associated with repeated stimulation of our amygdala. And Deepak Chopra referred to this part of our brain, the amygdala, as our reptilian brain. It's unevolved. It's primal. It invokes a stress response, our primal response. We are ready for fight or flight. So when we have repeated views of this, what happens in our brains at that time is it instantly releases hormones, our stress hormones, cortisol, adrenaline start coursing through our bodies. We start feeling blood pressure rising, heart rate rising, the tension. It is a physical feeling. You can actually feel it happening. We are ready for fight or flight, except we're not going anywhere. We're just looking out of a window at this. So it fuels and stays within our body and has nowhere to go and just keeps fueling itself. And so what Stephen Kellett, and more of him later, said, this is actually almost the equivalent of a nature deficit disorder. And as he put it beautifully, we walk through concrete streets, into concrete buildings, nature-free, into drab, gloomy offices, and we're expected to be at our best, really? So our nature deficit is actually causing us a physical, a mental, and a social crisis. And as it was quoted here at the very bottom in a great article I read actually in the Derren Hall newsletter, we're not pretending that good design can solve all our problems and all our existential crises, but it can and it should create spaces that calm and restore us. We have the toolkit available to create healthy spaces, and it's something that we should now be doing. Okay, bear with me, guys. So sorry. Always happens, it's just too many lozenges this morning, forgive me. Okay. So if I do want everyone in our building to be healthy, in my home, in my family's home, in my client's home, how do I design it? Well, actually by using a favourite part of sustainable interior design practice, by using biophilic design principles, as I like to call it, nature's toolkit. And you may have heard of it, biophilia's been mentioned a lot recently, in the last couple of years in particular. But as we've got the afternoon here together, let's just agree between us what it means exactly. And there's a danger, I think, in today's cognitively overloaded, information-saturated world that biophilic design can sometimes be limited and reduced to just being about planting, about pot plants. That's a really important part. I wouldn't dream of taking that away. It's a key strategy. Lovely. More plants, the better. But actually, when it's at its best and correctly applied, for me, biophilic design needs to reflect the natural environment and deliver multi-sensory, richly layered, variable sensory environments that uses nature's physical and natural materials. Because nature is extraordinarily varied. The term biophilia, you may know, was coined by biologist, lovely man, E.O. Wilson, Edward Wilson, from his book, The Biophilia Hypothesis, way back in the 1980s. So we are so late to the party on this. But in it, he said that as living organisms, we human beings have an innate, which means genetically predisposed, connectivity to nature, to natural forms and natural processes. And our regular, meaningful immersion into nature isn't just optional, it's critical to our health and well-being. You cut that out and you cut an enormous chunk of our medicine, our natural medicine, out as well. And this was then later applied, if you like, developed by Stephen Kellett and Judith Heelwagon in their first book when it came out on Biophilic Design. And they extrapolated the hypothesis from Edward Wilson into this and saying, well, okay, how do we make it work for environment? How can we create biophilic spaces using his theorems? Judith and Stephen Kellett came up with 73 different design protocols and attributes, which is huge, more than just planting. But because that was quite a lot to get your head around, Terrapin Green then helped us by further distilling that into what they called 14 patterns of biophilic design, broadly under those three categories that you can see there, in nature in space, natural analogues, and nature of the space. I'll leave that off for a second. But we know instinctively that nature is good for us and being in a natural environment is good for us, but how do we know that biophilic design actually works and whether it does whether there's any proof of it? So sorry. the added appeal for me of biophilic design and my background's in science is that it's a design discipline that's underpinned with evidence-based, applicable scientific research. So we can now say to our clients or to our families, okay, this is what we're doing, this is our design. These are the benefits that you will receive physically, emotionally, cognitively, and here's the science to prove it. That's a powerful conversation that we can finally have. It's not an aesthetic choice, this is scientific underpinned choice. And we know from decades worth of research that when we apply it to building spaces, that it can positively affect, in particular, our nervous and autonomic nervous systems, the things that we are not aware of, really, things that bubble up underneath. You'll see that for all the examples we talk about today, every one of those interventions calms and restores us and lowers our blood pressure and pulse rate. It's also great, we've mentioned, about spiking our creativity, problem solving. It restores our attentional fatigue, just a note on that one. Only if you immerse yourself. A pot plant staring at a cactus won't do it. You need to be immersed in nature for that to really work properly. So in the time we have today, sadly not 73 attributes, not even 14, but I'll go through a couple from each category so that you'll know how to apply them in your own designs. That's okay, we're doing for time. Sorry. Okay, and I'll start off with one which you might think is a bit unusual, because usually you think if you biophilic design, right, straight to nature, straight to planting. But actually I'm going to talk about lighting. That's part of, let me just go back to the beginning of that. So nature in space, it's one of the dynamic and diffuse lights, so it's in that first group. So this is an enormous subject in its own right, and I won't do it any justice at all by talking about it here, but I'll just touch on a few things about it. Daylight is our primary sleep regulator. So in order to sleep well, we need this stuff, and lots of it, more than we imagined. Daylight elevates our mood, but it also balances our hormones. Our bodies know when to metabolize fat and when to store it, when to regenerate the liver or skin cells that have been injured and when not to. Every process in our body has a particular time of day when it needs to do that. But how does it know to do that? It sets its own clock. And its clock is set by this bright blue rich light. For anyone who's a photographer here, this is the opposite of when you need to go and take photos. This is that harsh blue light that no one does when you take photographs. And it's ideally around noontime. So hopefully you had your dose before you came up here, although we're quite spoilt here having some so much of it. And it's this that we set our body clocks back by, and our circadian entrainment begins. So we begin at noon, and it then tells us our eyes receive the light, and even if we have no sight, because they're not sight receptors, our eyes then register it's noon and say, okay, right, then melatonin, the darkness hormone, needs to start being secreted about 8 or 9 hours later, and that helps us to go to sleep. And then it stops being secreted about 7:30, but my one hasn't got the memo on that. Mine definitely carries on long into the morning. But it's that entrainment that sets the rest of our body clock for our hormones. So anything that stops that being kicked off, or melatonin from being secreted between 9 and 7, will affect our entire process. So your Twitter scroll at 2 in the morning when you're getting out of bed and just check your notifications is enough to stop that from happening. Any blue light can affect you. And even if you go back off to sleep, the melatonin secretion would have stopped. And what you then end up doing... Oh, gosh, no, not too soon. Oh, no, so sorry, guys. So what you then end up doing is, yes, you may go off to sleep, but day after day of repeated, and this is where my professor said it's partially poor design, of being polluted by blue light. His words, not mine. But his point was energy-efficient lights are that blue end of spectrum, so they also mimic that noon light. All our devices are set to this blue light. And his point was, what were you thinking when you were doing this? All of those things that we have to then potentially switch off when we have to get ready and prepare our minds for bedtime or whatever it might be so the rest of our world can kick in, stops us from doing this. And we can do it now and again, fine, but if it's on repeat, if we do it day in, day out, and if we're exposed to blue light every day, then there is an economic cost to sleep deprivation, but also a health cost. We're more likely to have a whole host of illnesses, not just feeling fatigued or unable to concentrate, which if you haven't had a good night's sleep, you know about. But if it's repeated, then chronic depression, heart conditions, and adrenal failure also kick in. And this is simply as a result of a disrupted secretion to melatonin or disrupted circadian pattern. Sorry. So sorry. Okay, so what do we need to do? Well, firstly, do something for yourselves. Drench yourselves in this early morning light for at least 30 minutes. Treat it as a prescription. So 30 minutes of daylight. And then seek it for a further 2 hours of your day. So work by a window if you can. I mean, we're lucky here because we have got gorgeous daylight. That's really unusual. I've been in places where there are no windows at all, so that'd be much harder. But 30 minutes of critical daylight on prescription and 2 hours of further exposure will be enough. And in the way that we used to have, or we still do have, Fitbits that will regulate all your other bodily functions that you need to do and how many steps you've walked, I think there are a couple of companies that are now working on, one's going to be called, I think, a Daisy Meter, where you have it on your lapel and it will tell you whether you've had enough exposure to the appropriate blue-rich light. And if it will work out how many hours are left, and it'll give you a beep beep to go and get some sunshine because it won't be enough to kick you in. That's going to be quite a game changer, actually. I can't wait for that to come out. That'd be lovely. And there's a problem, actually, when I say to you, you've got to find 2 hours of daylight space because we're not lucky enough. Well, if you're working, that's going to be difficult. And our interior spaces, according to a great lighting research designer, Mariana Figaro, has said that our interior environments are just too dark. On a cloudy day, inside is 10 times darker than an outside cloudy day. As designers and architects, we need to wise up and address this, because that is also part of our problem, according to the professor. He really didn't like us very much at all. And then what we need to do after this injection of blue light, if you like, is shield us. So we have to move from that to this. So literally following the sun. So after a while, we need to shield ourselves away from blue light and move towards that warm glow, which actually incandescent light bulbs, I know that's unfashionable, but that's what they used to do. They were that side of the spectrum. So actually, if we had blue light when we were working and this light incandescence, then we would have followed that. We don't do that anymore. Although I'll come back to what there's a possibility of that being addressed now. Just see if I got it. And ideally dim your lights, and completely unrealistic to say all devices off 2 hours before bedtime, but that is the recommendation. Maybe unusually to start off by affiliate design talking about lighting, but actually I don't think without daylight we have healthy homes or healthy lives. So we should put that as our first priority, whatever you end up designing. So what are your design protocols with this? Well, full access or optimal daylight. If you are lucky to have huge windows, leave them like that. Don't impede them with window treatments that will reduce and restrict it. Bring in reflectance materials nearer to the windows to bounce it into floor plates as much as you can. That's it. And also, just there will be, there are already progress being made about circadian lighting. Has anyone here heard of it or seen it, used it, circadian lighting? But that literally follows the path of the sun. So your light source, lighting source, will change from rich blue to warm glow. They've got them in commercial spaces, or beginning to have them. And actually the ones where it's really important are care homes and hospitals, because you become so institutionalized there. So it's really important to adapt them there. But they'll sooner or later, I guess, will also hit residential markets as well. But that's the one I'm looking forward to doing as well. Okay, sorry. And the benefits are absolutely critical to your sleep-wake cycle and your entire being. So don't underestimate the importance of daylight. I remember a student once years ago said that for one of her projects, she was going to do a cave residential area, so there was no light, and I just begged her not to for all the for all the reasons. So no, really important. Also good for visual comfort. Your eyes will thank you for it as well. And secondly, views out to nature. Well, this is a more obvious aspect of maybe what you're used to of biophilic design. But actually, not even just views out to nature, if you're lucky enough to have that, but imagery of nature as well. And even small amounts of nature in any space will create a strong biophilic effect. The positive impact of nature can actually be felt within 5 minutes. So immerse yourself in something for just 5 minutes and you will feel an effect. For that effect to be more lasting and more meaningful, 20 minutes. So if you're creating interior spaces, create places, and I'll explain how, that will keep somebody's attention there between 5 and 20 minutes to attain a full biophilic effect. And again, I just come back to, I mean, poor cactus. Cactus did no wrong, but a cactus on a desk doesn't do that. But it's just how can we do it? Viewing natural scenes also stimulates the same part of our brain that we mentioned earlier, our pleasure receptors, and actually we don't tire of it. You know, you can look at a geometric pattern and after a while, move to something else. I can also, I'm saying far too much about my own creative issues, I could stare out of a kitchen window at my garden forever and not get bored. So it's that, it does keep our attention going and keeps rewarding us. If you need to solve a problem, look or immerse yourself, ideally go for a walk or immerse yourself in nature. If you're in a walk with trees, so much the better. They give off things called phytoncides, which actually boost your immune system, but they are known to increase mental alertness. So just the act of walking outside or look at a view or indoor planting will change your brainwave activity. And as your blood pressure decreases, your cognitive functioning increases. So what you couldn't cope with because it was all right in front of you on a laptop, suddenly walk away, stare at something natural or be in it, that goes down, cognitive ability goes up, and suddenly the problems go. It really, and honestly, does work. And then this is the other thing that's really boosting and a great booster, I suppose, but extra bonus, is that being in nature or natural environments has another effect on us from an emotional perspective. It actually boosts our optimism and happiness. Those feelings, those kind of positive feelings. So even if we haven't solved our problem on a walk, we feel pretty sure we can by the time we're back at our desk. It gives you that kind of bounce. So actually just having that exposure has been really positive. So if you're lucky enough to have views out to nature, make that the star of the show. Nothing should or can really compete with it. Prioritise real nature over simulated nature. By that I mean artwork, potentially, or graphics, or those kind of things. So, and then as opposed to no nature. So no nature is the worst. Having artwork or some representation is fine, because it'll do something for you, but have real nature if you can possibly do it. There's a diminishing return. And if you have no views out to nature, bring it in. And this is where planting helps brilliantly. Admittedly, this is a commercial space, but it's in, I think it's in New York. So a very urban environment. But fringing that all with greenery brings nature right into you, makes it front and centre. So there's another opportunity if you don't have the luxury of having views out. And you don't need much. Again, a load of studies have now recently come out because people don't have the luxury of what we've just seen. We're living in urban megacities. So how do you carve out your little oasis? Not much is required. You only need a small amount of space with real nature in it to create that same effect. If you then couple it like they have here with an open window, which then has a breeze through it, you enhance the effect. If you have something here which has got light with shimmer and shade and dappleness, that'll enhance the effect. So it doesn't take much. And there are certain species of plants that we know are also fantastic as air purifiers. But okay, caveat. I think we may have thought we didn't need as many as we actually do. We may have thought we just need the odd one across our desk. Recently, a research from a piece from an Australian university has worked out exactly the purifying effects, because it's quite a physical process, and it's more than we think. So for an average room of about 5 metres by 4 metres, you need, the magic number is 10, substantial plants. These are medium to tall, floor-standing ones. Large-leafed, lots of soil, healthy soil, because the process is that the VOCs and chemicals are absorbed through the leaves, so you need large leaf area. They then get broken down through the roots and dispersed through the soil. So you need that quantity to create an effect. Now, you don't need that volume of plants to have a biophilic effect, but this is the added thing if you want to also add air purifying. And on a room that's 8 by 8, I'm really rubbish on this. Is this about 8 metres? We just know. Anyway, 8 by 8 metres, kind of this sort of size. 32 plants. So that's substantial. It would be lovely. If I had 32 plants here, I'd be the happiest girl. And it would be immersed in nature. Actually, it wouldn't help me. It would help you a lot. But actually, you'd be going into your attentional restoration, so you'd be feeling really almost sleepy with it. So actually, there's a fine balance between those two. I'm so sorry. So to summarise, there we go. Our views to nature prioritise it over simulated, and each one of those interventions, and there are many, many more, will all of them, every single one of the science that's underpinned this, has shown that it will lower your stress levels, it will decrease your blood pressure, your pulse rates, and more importantly, this is the one that you put in that restores your attentional fatigue. There's an extraordinary report that I read recently that showed that teenage schoolgirls, I don't know why teenage schoolgirls were picked, because I'm sure schoolboys would have had the same reaction, but those who had those who have the opportunity of being in a place that has access to nature, either outside or within their own space, were shown they were more able to master what they called the self-discipline skills of focus, concentration, completing a task, and avoiding delaying gratification. And as opposed to teenage girls who were in urban environments, who were the opposite of that. There was a jitteriness about them. They couldn't completely sit and complete a long, involved task without searching for something. And it might be social media, or it might be a biscuit, or it might be something. It's that kind of feeling. And the report authors concluded that actually mastery of those self-discipline skills, as they called them, at an early and developmental age was critical, not just to your academic success, but in professional and for the rest of your life. So when we sometimes talk about the disparity of society, about society's unequal mobility, and we speak about backgrounds and we speak about schooling, actually our environment, but more importantly, the access we have to nature within our environment is becoming more important perhaps than we've ever considered. So despite our own genetics, that could be something we could help ourselves on. Sorry guys, I'm going to run through this quite quickly. But for our non-visual connection to nature, as I call it, design for the senses, this is a gorgeous part of design. Huge topic, which I won't do justice today, but it covers things like colour, which is a powerful tool for conveying mood. Also, more increasingly, soundscaping and sound therapy, which has been brilliant as well, particularly in the US, in spa and wellness drop-in centres, which help with attentional restoration, fatigue as well. Particular kind of sound waves that really help with that. But I'm going to just choose a couple of very brief examples for us here today. One of them is the importance of touch, and you can use that obviously through richly textured and contrasting softness from natural materials where we have an embarrassment of riches. And I love this quote, that the engagement of touch requires our brains to slow down and engage at the scale of fingertip. Even saying that feels relaxing. If you think about a child with a comfort blanket, or when you repeatedly, just without even knowing, continually to stroke or touch something that's soft, you visibly and physically slow down and concentrate on something. And again, it restores our alpha wave activity. And there's that can be further enhanced, excuse me, by providing different textures of different coarseness or softness, which can heighten this particular appeal. And in a bedroom, for example, where you've got soft blankets or bedding, The contrast of that would be using wood. And by the way, wood in bedrooms, super good. Because the other thing that our professor, you know, the one who doesn't like us very much, he mentioned that the sleep deprivation, not just down to blue light, which is one of his big enemies, but it's also because of our prevalence now, or becoming prevalent, our wireless world. And the problems we have with EMF, electromagnetic frequency. And we're just about to launch to 5G. This is emerging, so I don't have hard scientific research. I'm actually going to a conference next week on that one. But the same people who are ringing the alarm bells on EMF were the same ones who were talking about chemical overload, so I'm paying attention. And it's thought that it affects everyone according to the research that I've seen, but there are canaries in the coal mine who we should pay attention to, who it really affects. And it's thought that it changes our brainwave pattern, particularly the brain that gets us into deep sleep at night. So that's why the sleep deprivation bit is an issue with EMF as well. But wood is a natural insulator, electrical insulator, and anti-static, and absorbs sound. So that could be part of our antidote. And I know I keep saying it to everybody, like, no electrical devices in the bedroom. I mean, you have to keep saying it. I don't know how likely that is, but that's the point, to keep all of it out, not just off or silent. EMF picks up, circulates around the whole house, doesn't it, if you're at home. So to have no devices in your bedroom. Skip through the rest of it, sorry guys. I'll come back onto that one. We mentioned at the beginning that nature abhors a right angle. There are no right angles in nature, none. And yet very difficult to do a kitchen without having right angles. Everything is kind of geared around to being straight lined and edges. So the designer here decided to soften that appeal and bring it to more biophilic effect by changing things up and putting in things like Vietnamese water buckets, which are those what you can see here, just to soften it out as well. It also achieves, and I hope I've got this right, the Japanese expression of wabi-sabi, which is perfect imperfection, thank you. Nature doesn't try to be perfect. Leaves are now falling on the ground, they're not lining themselves up like soldiers. It's just kind of scattered. And if we go into a house which has very firm, fine lines, and you sit on a very upright cushion, do you really feel relaxed there? We don't feel at ease. We need to have a bit more perfect imperfection to relax us and to sort of ease us into the space. So these are a couple of other examples. This is Etsy's headquarters, actually, in Brooklyn. And another one here. Oops. And bring scent into your design as well. Scents or smelling is most powerful of all our senses, because the scent goes straight through to our receptors into our part of our brain completely directly that creates memories. Creates memories, and I forget what I'm going to mention at that stage as well. That's not very clever. And it goes into our limbic system, which releases our hormones, either excitatory, yeah, I love this smell, or get the hell out of this house, like something's wrong here, gas, or inhibitory. Lavender, for example, has been shown without any further doubt, causes a decrease in your blood pressure, undoubtedly now we know that, and heart rate. Also, rosemary and sage essential oils, if you're revising, they increase your mental alertness. Actually, I found that really helped as well. So just those two things as well. Unlike any other sense, this has a direct link to the brain. All other senses, touch, visual ones, even our taste, go through a processing center and then go into our hormone one, the limbic system. By that point, the memory of it has faded somewhat, and the effect is somewhat distilled. Scent is powerful. If you think about it, if you had your eyes closed and you were given a scent that you remembered as a child, you could place yourself there like that. More than perhaps if you saw an abstract bit of wallpaper, you'd have to think about it maybe more clearly. So scent is quite a powerful thing. Bring scent in. This is actually from Derring Hall as well. I haven't tried this, but I think this is a cool idea. Because eucalyptus is also an invigorating oil, and the suggestion was to hang a fresh eucalyptus over your shower. Warm water will release the oils, it'll wake you up and it'll invigorate you. Don't know how effective that is, but I think I might have to give that a go. Okay, and I will skip through this very quickly. I'm sorry if I'm keeping everyone, please go if you need to. If you use nature's analogues, these are natural references. These are mathematical pieces of genius. Golden sections, Fibonacci sections, the kind of rhythmic mathematical perfection that you see in sunflowers or cauliflowers, broccoli or snail shells. It's that kind of thing. Actually, we we grew up, our ancestors grew up recognizing nature's fractal patterns. It was our sat-nav. It's how we navigated the natural landscape. So we're familiar with them. And when we go into space, when we see fractal patterns, our brains relax and we feel much more rested as a result. Again, versus sharp geometry. And actually, you've got some of those here in this showroom as well. It's from the new Raw collection, I understand, from Taiping. But it's to use those. You see those often in textiles, in design prints, in art, in wall coverings as well as floor coverings. And a couple of our examples here. This is a garden in Sicily. They've made it into a honeycomb and planted scented plants where you can sit or walk past, and that plays either bird songs or classical music in the middle of a city. I wish we had that. That would be just awesome to have that here. Others bring them inside, couple that with planting for an enhanced effect. This is Kit Kemp's hotel, botanical motifs, which have been abstracted. And this is a way of doing it through different types of lamp pendants, either through fractals or through soft natural materials. This is all cork, or through botanical motifs. Okay, nearly there, guys. So just two more and I'll leave you with it. And the final section that in our 14 patterns of biophilic design was nature of space. And two of the really interesting characteristics of that are something called prospect and refuge. And prospect is, as you would imagine, something you can see at a distance, which is why I asked if anyone here loved mountains or that kind of view. Very few people do, funnily enough, but those that do love that aspect of it, the prospect of it. And again, this is how in our ancestral times, we quite happily stood on a vantage point, almost like Lion King-like, and looked across the savannah. And that way you can pick out your moments of shelter or safety, where you could go to, and your food sources. You were there surveying the land. We still like doing that, and the way we adapt it into our homes is having open plan. So a whole open plan where you can see things happening, you can see social activities, you can see where you're going to go, what's happening in the gardens, or from staircases, or from mezzanine levels, or from balconies. We've done a lot of that. We've bashed down walls and created open plan. But sometimes at the expense of the one thing we now need more than we've needed anything else, and that's providing refuge. So in tearing down the walls, what we've missed out is the need to find calm and restoring spaces, the places that nurture us and just make us cozied up, where we can just push out the rest of the world, all the things that are trying to come in, when we're cognitively and socially overloaded, to create these designated nooks, if you like, that are intended to create joy. They don't have to be separate rooms. It could just be a special place where you go and just be. That first question, where are you at your happiest? Where are you happy? Just being. And that could be just somewhere where you're going to read a book, your favourite chair with a perfectly positioned lamp above it. It's just perfection. And you don't need much space carved in between stairs here. Or by a window, which would be even better. So as you can see, in this short period of time we've had, and thank you for being so patient and post-lunch, there's a vast subject to talk about on biophilic design. And it's something that is explicitly around the nurturing and our own physical, emotional and mental well-being. That's its entire purpose. So if you go along with it, how do you know if you've done it successfully? Well, Judith Heelwagon, from that book that you saw at the very beginning, she gave us this really handy little checklist. She said, okay, you've designed things biophilically if you ask yourself, is your design beautiful? Nature is, in every sense. It has to be too. Does it engage all your senses? Are there places that you've created where your soul can engage, where you feel alive and alert, but also where your mind can rest, where you can just chill out and be somewhere else for a while? Does it use natural geometry as opposed to hard, straight angles? How much of nature's variable patterns and textures and materials have you used? What processes have you included? Is there a breeze being pushed through? Is there light that's dappled and diffused in your area? How much of the variability and sensory environment have you included? And most importantly, and I agree with this one, does it provide delight and amusement? I mean, we spend 90% of our lives within here. They should make us happy. We should have something in our design that when we get up and walk past it, it makes us smile. So yes, I think although we can't solve all our problems, good design can help provide us with spaces that do calm and restore us. And thank you, I've really overrun, but you've been lovely. Thank you very much. But happy to take Q&A, sorry.